Well, good evening and welcome back to the Journey Home program. I'm your host, John Mark Grodi, and once again, we have this great privilege here in EWTN to hear a story of the good things that God has done in our lives. We're joined tonight by Justin Hibbard. He's a former evangelical minister, and he's the host of the Why Catholic podcast that you can find if you search we're all good podcasters, you know. Great to have you with us tonight,
Justin. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it's good to have you here. We've been connected for a while through the Coming Home Network, and I think we'll hear about that a little bit later, but it's great to finally have you on the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah. Well, I'll step out of the way, take us way back, and give us a bit of the backstory for your particular journey.
Yeah. So I grew up in a Seventh-day Baptist home. A lot of people think Seventh-day Adventist.
Right.
Seventh-day Baptist is one of the smallest Baptist denominations in the world. Okay. Very tight-knit. I come from a Seventh-day Baptist legacy. My grandfather was a Seventh-day Baptist pastor and a church planner. My dad's an elder. My mom grew up in a town that was planted by Seventh-day Baptists in Arkansas, and I met my wife through our Seventh-day Baptist network. She grew up in a town in Minnesota that was planted by Seventh-day Baptists. So we had this legacy, and we were active in church. We went to church every Saturday. In fact, I joke that I missed church once growing up, and that's because I was born on a Saturday. So if I was born on a Friday, I'm sure I'd have been on church on Saturday.
Yeah.
And then and we would go to these camps and retreats and annual conferences everywhere around the country. And so you get to meet people from all over the world. And so that was my upbringing, and just a real big part of my identity. On top of that, my parents valued Christian education. So they put me in Protestant Christian schools from preschool all the way up through college. Yeah. And so I had, I was memorizing Bible verses at age 4. You know, we had the letters of the alphabet, and A was all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. You know, so I remember these. And so I just had a big biblical education, and Christian education was really important in our family. I got to be really good at pretending to be a Christian, you know, at talking the Christian language and convincing people that, you know, here I am, this pious, holy guy, whatever. But in middle school, even though as a young kid, I remember saying the sinner's prayer, and, you know, I didn't want to go to hell. You know, who wanted to go to hell? So I wanted to go to heaven. And so I said the sinner's prayer. But in middle school, it became very clear, like, I didn't really have a personal relationship with Jesus. And I would go to this Seventh-day Baptist camp every summer, and we would... And I would look at the camp counselors who are college students, and I'm like, they just have a peace about them, and they have a joy about them that was infectious. I want that too, you know. Well, the summer before my freshman year of high school, I was pretty lost. I was feeling really depressed, and I knew I'm coming up on this camp, and I was like, either I'm going to become a Christian and like really give my life to Jesus, or I don't know what's going to happen, you know? And so I went to that camp and I said to the Lord, I said, okay, God, if you're real, I need you to do these three specific things, you know? And it wouldn't make sense to anyone else, but for me, it was like these three little things that I really wanted the Lord to do. And he did it over the course of that week. And the night before the last night of camp, there was this huge storm. And I remember... I was always kind of afraid of storms, and it was loud. I was like, there's going to be a tornado coming through this camp at any point, you know, and I was a little bit nervous, but my soul was at peace. And I realized what happened was over the course of that week, you know, kind of like C.S. Lewis getting on the bus, like I got on the bus and I wasn't a Christian, and got off the bus and I am, you know, and I was kind of like, got into that camp. I don't know if I was a Christian, and I left that camp a totally changed person.
Wow.
So much so that I went home and I had subscribed to this music video service where they send you these VHS tapes, and they weren't very wholesome. And so I got home and I wrote a letter to them and I said, please cancel my subscription. I've given my life to Jesus. You know, this isn't really helpful for me, and if you would like to give your life to Jesus too, I'd be happy to talk with you about it. I was just sold out,
yeah.
You know, and really love the Lord. I started blogging, and I would just write. I was reading C.S. Lewis's God in the Docks, and I just loved the way that he presented theology in a way that really captured your imagination, that really helped you understand it. And I was like, I want to do this. And so I would write these like emails, and it was like these theology emails, and I would send it out. It was like 11th, 12th grade. And I get people on my email list and send it out. I was like blogging before blogging was a thing,
sure.
But I love that theological approach to it.
Yeah.
a big part of my story also involved a man named Gary Dereshinsky. We called him Mr. D. He was a Bible teacher that I had in seventh grade. He came from a Jewish home and converted to Christianity, and then he worked for Chosen People Ministries, working with Jewish evangelism, and then moved to the Annapolis area where he taught at Annapolis Area Christian School, where I attended, and then also he was at a church called New Hope Chapel as a bivocational pastor. So Gary was just such an engaging teacher, really knew the Bible. He also was a great musician. And so he said to me and a couple other kids, hey, let's start a chapel worship band. And so got us into that. I played piano, and so I was learning how to play worship music and chords and everything like that. And that was a lot of fun. I went up to the high school, and Gary went up to the high school as well. So I had him in high school as a Bible teacher, and just such an engaging teacher. And one day he says to me, Justin, you go to church on Saturdays. What if you came to New Hope Chapel on Sundays and played on our worship team? And I said, yeah, I like that idea. Let's do that. So for a while, I had a 7-day-a-week biblical education, five days with Gary at school, Saturdays at my Seventh-day Baptist church, and Sunday at this church called New Hope Chapel and played on the worship team. And so what I realized now is how much that formed me both spiritually and as a musician. Yeah. So that was my kind of high school upbringing. After I graduated high school, I did a summer through our Seventh-day Baptist denomination called Summer Christian Service Corps, where I served at a teen center in Michigan. And then in the next summer, I joined our denomination's band called Stained Glass, and we would cut an album, and then we'd rehearse in Southern California, and we'd travel the whole country, and we'd end at the Seventh-day Baptist annual conference. And it was a grueling, like, 2-3 months of traveling and concerts and everything like that. So I only did that 1 year, but I'm glad I got to do that.
Yeah.
I ended up going to Houghton College, which is associated with the Wesleyan Church.
Where's that at?
In Western New York.
Gotcha.
Yep. So I went there and got plugged in with a Seventh-day Baptist church up there in Western New York. But then all my friends went to church on Sunday, so I would often go to church with them, whether it's a Pentecostal church or a Wesleyan church. And so really had a kind of a diverse background. But my junior year is kind of really where my story with Catholicism starts, because I went abroad to Sevilla, Spain. And this was the first time I was not at a Christian school. And it was the first time. Also, I, for whatever reason, I chose not to get plugged into a local church, like a Protestant church. I know there's a few out there, but I didn't get plugged in. So I wasn't going to church, and I wasn't around in this Christian school environment anymore. And I remember feeling very spiritually dehydrated. Probably a good way to say that. And it was also during the time of the September 11th attacks. Wow. So it was really unsettling and just kind of uncertainty. And I remember one day thinking, I want to go somewhere to pray. And I don't know why I wanted to go somewhere to pray. Like, I could pray anywhere. But what was drawing me to a place? I don't know. And not knowing anything about Catholicism, I didn't know I could go to any of the dozens of churches right near me within a stone's throw. And so I went to the church I knew would be open, the cathedral in Sevilla, which is the third largest cathedral in the world. And I would go in and I would ask the guards, can I just go in and pray and not have to pay? And they would let me do that. And I did that a couple of times. And there was something oddly peaceful about it. You know, I didn't know anything about the Eucharist, and that was there. You know, it was, the Eucharist was in the tabernacle. I didn't understand that concept, but I just went there to pray. And I ended up meeting a classmate, and she said, you know, Justin, I'm Catholic. I go to church. I go to Mass on Sunday nights. Would you like to join me? Mm-hmm. I was like, sure. So I went to Mass with her, and we would go every Sunday night. And, you know, I didn't know the Catholic liturgy in English, let alone Spanish. So I'm just mumbling along. I probably look like a third base coach out there. Like, you know.
What did you think about it? I mean, obviously very different from your worship experience growing up.
Yeah. So it was funny because I really did not like liturgical services. I much preferred the rock band feel, the animated pastor kind of approach. And yet I found the liturgy to be beautiful. and something oddly comforting to it. I didn't know anything about it. I didn't really understand the order. I went up to and received communion, even though I didn't know, you know, I just didn't know better, right? So, when my parents visited, we went to, my cousins also visited at the end of my term, and we went to a Christmas Eve Mass. And I'm sure my parents were like, we let him go to Spain and now he's become Catholic, you know, like, and my cousins were Catholic. So they knew what they were doing. And, but I came home from that experience and I thought, maybe I'll just keep going to a Catholic church. So I went to a Catholic church up in Western New York. Now in Spain, I had like the 17th century experience. Mm-hmm. In New York, it was more like the 1970s experience. And so I was like, this is very different.
Very different.
And I was also surrounded by my Protestant friends and everything like that. And I was like, okay, maybe I'm not Catholic, you know, maybe that was just a phase for 4 months. So I call it my 4 months of being Catholic, you know? So that was my experience there. Now, as I was graduating college, my home church in Maryland, Seventh-day Baptist Church, the pastor wanted to retire. And he was lobbying hard for me to come in and be the pastor. And to kind of talk a little bit about my home church, like, it's Seventh-day Baptists, because it's such a small, tight-knit community, people are very committed to the denomination and very committed to that. And they don't, you know, when there's problems, you don't see people leaving the church. And so what ends up happening is a lot of times problems get swept under the rug. There's a lot of interpersonal conflicts and people just deal with it because this is the only Seventh-day Baptist church around. Like, I don't have another place to go. Yeah. And so there were a lot of interpersonal conflicts at my home church, a lot of challenges. And so I was like, I feel called to go back and to serve. Now, I don't feel called to be a pastor for the rest of my life. I don't feel that calling, but I do feel called to go back and help my church. And maybe I can help in some way, you know? I'm younger, you know? And so I said, my fiance and I, we were about to get married. And I said to her, what do you think? You know, he's asking me to be the pastor. What do you think about that? And she's like, I don't think it's a good idea. And I was like, well, I feel like I'm being called to this. And she's like, I don't think it's a good idea. Yeah. But she was like, if this is what you feel called to, we'll do it. So I came back home and I became the pastor at, I may have been 22. Mm-hmm. You know, I was barely 22. And I mean, talk about a prophet in your own hometown. I mean, these are people that changed my diaper as a kid. These are people I called aunt and uncle, you know, like it was really weird. Mm-hmm. And it was really hard. And I think I was completely naive and pretty immature in thinking that I could just come in and I can do this. Like I can, you know, and there were some really traumatic experiences that happened during that time. But another thing that happened was I get a call one day from Gary, my old Bible teacher.
Yeah.
And Gary says to me, hey, Justin, I hear you're a pastor at your Seventh-day Baptist church. He's like, that's awesome. He's like, we need a worship pastor. What would you think about pastoring your church on Saturdays and coming over here and being the worship pastor at New Hope Chapel on Sundays? And I said, I love that idea. Let's do that, you know? And so I went into New Hope Chapel and it was such a different vibe. It was so wonderful working with these different musicians and just a very different environment. And so I'm on the leadership team there and we're having, you know, elders meetings and things like that. And I'm like, this is way different than my Seventh-day Baptist church. Like this is really healthy. And I said to my wife, I said, I think my time pastoring at the Seventh-day Baptist church is over. And she was like, well, what do we do after that? Do we go to, you know, another Seventh-day Baptist church? I mean, the nearest one is in D.C., about an hour away. Mm-hmm. You know, do we do that? And I said, my church community is right here. You know, like New Hope Chapel has been everything that I've ever looked for in a church community. And I don't really feel like being a commuter to another church. But what I knew I was giving up, and this was the hardest part, was that you know, it wasn't just about a church. It's about that whole denomination. And we have friends from all over the world. We have relatives. You know, we have a legacy as a Seventh-day Baptist. And so I knew I was giving that up. And that was the hardest part. It was devastating. And I think it was really hard on our marriage. It was hard on our families, you know, when we decided we were going to leave the denomination, because we knew we might not see those people again. And yeah. those people mean so much to us, and they've been a real big part of our upbringing. So that was really, really, really challenging. Yeah. So I did that. So we left the Seventh-day Baptist Church. I was just getting more and more involved at New Hope Chapel. I need another job, so I ended up teaching at my alma mater, Annapolis Area Christian School, as a Spanish teacher and teaching the worship team there, which was great because I got to work with Gary 5 days a week right. at the school, and then on Sundays we're working together as well. And mm-hmm. so I couldn't have asked for a better mentor. I mean, he was someone who was just patient and kind and had a real solid biblical foundation. I mean, just to be able to learn from him week after week. I mean, he brought an exegetical teaching to the Bible that was amazing. And on top of that, he would bring a lot of the Jewish roots to our church. So during the High Holy Days, you know, he'd preach on Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot. During Sukkot, we'd build a sukkah in the sanctuary, which is a little booth. Mm. And then we'd have a Passover Seder. We'd bring them like a messianic flair to that as well. And he said to me one day, he goes, "Justin, I've got an idea for a ministry. It's called Christianity is Jewish." And that's named after the book that Edith Schaefer wrote, Francis Schaefer's wife. And he's like, "We could use this to teach Jewish people about how Jesus is the fulfillment of Judaism. And we could teach Gentile Christians about the Jewish roots of the faith." And I was like, "Gary, this is brilliant. I love it." I was like, I'm on board, you know. And so I helped build the website. I was in web design. I'm like, "Build the website." We were doing radio ads. Everything was cooking. We were having big Passover Seder, inviting the community to it. And so I was really excited. So this was an awesome ministry that I was involved in. I was doing a lot of writing and researching and really learning about the Jewish roots of Christianity in a way that I had never had. And I was just very passionate about it. Well, one day Gary says to me, he goes, "Justin, I've gotten a call to go out to pastor a Messianic church in California, and I think I'm going to take it." And I was like, I was devastated because here's my mentor. Here's yeah. a guy that I've loved working with for years. And he said, you know, and we were just getting going with the Christianity is Jewish thing. And I was like, I totally understood, though. I mean, he had worked two jobs for 20 years as a teacher and a pastor. And he was getting an opportunity to work with a Messianic church out in California. Totally understood and was excited for him. But it's definitely our loss, you know. Yeah. So the day he announced, my wife said to me, "You're not thinking about becoming a pastor, right? You're not thinking of stepping into his shoes." And I was like, no, I learned my lesson, you know, like we're not going to do that again. And everyone, like even the day he said he was leaving, like someone came up to me, he's like, "Justin, you're going to be the next pastor." And I'm like, nope, sorry. Like you're going to have to find someone else. And that just kept happening, like week after week, people asking me. And finally, I went home one day and I was like, you know, it was funny. Like someone was asking me about me being the pastor again. Like she just keeps nagging me. And my wife said, "You know, if all these people are asking you, you should consider it." Mm. And I was like, "What happened to my wife?" You know,
Holy Spirit.
So eventually I did become the pastor. And my approach was just like, this is going to be a team effort. Mm-hmm. We are going to work together because I'm working full time as a teacher and I can't preach every Sunday. And I want this to be about us. I don't want to be about, it's not about me. I want to make sure that New Hope Chapel is a place where we have different voices speaking into it. And there were a lot of gifted preachers, people who had been to seminary, former pastors in this small little church. So that was an amazing experience for us. Like I loved that time there.
Yeah.
But eventually it became a point where my wife and I go to nursing school. We had three little kids. I was working at this point, I'm working full time at a Catholic school. So I'd switched over to a Catholic school and, as an ed tech director. And it was interesting because, you know, I had that experience in college as with Catholicism, but I was very much like, I'd become very hardened to Catholic theology. And I think it's because I was like more and more entrenched in my evangelical teaching. And I was really into apologetics. Mm. So I would spend time, you know, arguing about Christianity, and really kind of coming from a Calvinist standpoint. Sure. So I would say it's like Reformed Baptist type
right.
of thing.
Justin, up to this point, like, what was your picture of Christianity? Like, where did the Seventh-day Baptists fit? Where did New Hope Chapel fit? Where did Catholicism fit? What did that map look like in your mind?
Yeah, it looked like I was right and everyone else was wrong. You know, I think I really yeah. saw this like, oh, you know, baptism by, you know, a believer baptism. I saw like a Calvinist theology to it. Mm-hmm. I saw Catholicism as this really kind of defunct form of Christianity and really boring. I was like, this is a stale, like, look at you guys. It's stale. It's lifeless. Like, what is this? Whereas like, come to our church, like we've got a rock band and we've got, you know, good preaching. And, I mean, I was definitely, I was very ecumenical, mm-hmm. But I was also, it was very much like the Jewish roots thing as well. Yeah. It's like, that was a real important part of, because when Gary left, I wanted to carry that on. So I learned how to do the Jewish roots of, mm-hmm. To preach on the Jewish roots and to lead Passover Seders and things like that. When I was at the Catholic school, you know, when it came, I would try to avoid going to Mass. Like we had Mass on a monthly basis. But when we had faculty meetings, we did Mass together. You can't really avoid that. But I would just kind of sit back. And there were some things that I really appreciated about the Mass, but I was really hard-hearted to it and closed-minded. And so when it came time for communion, I just kind of make them walk past me and I would stay in my seat. And there was one time towards the end of my tenure there that the rows were so tight, I had to get up. And so I got up and filed in line, you know, kind of begrudgingly, and get up and I crossed my chest for a blessing. And the priest, our chaplain, gave me the nicest blessing. And I don't know what it was, but it just like melted the walls. Like the walls just came tumbling down. I was like, that was so kind and so merciful and so peaceful. And here I had this like hard heart, you know, and I was begrudging being there. And so anytime we had Mass after that, I was sure to go up. I was like, I'd love this blessing, you know, this that the priest would give me, not really understanding the sacramental aspect of it. Well, this was about 11 years at New Hope Chapel. I was at 5 years at my alma mater, 5 years at this Catholic school. So I'm working two jobs. I've got three little kids. I have a side hustle doing web design. My wife wants to go to nursing school, and I'm like, this is exhausting, you know. And we wanted to move up to Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And so it provided an opportunity to say, you know, let's go ahead and make that move and step out of these different roles and just kind of maybe get one job and focus on that. And so that's what I did. I got into education technology on the sales side of things. But the thing about moving to Pennsylvania was this was the first time in a long time that I was not in ministry. Yeah. And so now I'm just a parishioner. And we attended a couple of different churches, a Mennonite church for a little while. And it was a very modern Mennonite church plant. And we attended a Presbyterian church for a little while. And I was like, I feel like something is missing from church. And I could not articulate it. But there were a number of Sundays, like we just didn't go to church, you know, and that was very rare because growing up, my life and as my kids' upbringing, and when I was a pastor, we were at church every Sunday. And it was just something I was like, I don't feel like going today, and I don't know that I'm going to miss anything. And I couldn't, and it was frustrating because I could not figure out why I felt that way. When the other part of this was that, we were attending that Presbyterian church during the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. And I thought, oh, this will be really interesting. Like, this is cool. I would consider myself a Calvinist, so I'm like pro-Reformation. And I felt really icky because it was a celebration of the Reformation. And people were like, thank God for Martin Luther and for him, like, you know, the taking down the evils of Catholicism or things like that. And I was like, you know, you read Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, and his dying wish is that his followers would be one as he and the Father are one. He wants us to emulate the mystical nature of the Trinity. And I was like, this definitely doesn't feel like that. It felt like we were celebrating a divorce.
Yeah.
And that just kind of circled in my mind. I was like, something's not sitting right with this. And I don't love it. we ended up moving to Utah for work, for lifestyle, skiing, all of that stuff. And so we got involved with an evangelical church out there, and same kind of thing. Like I would get involved, and there were a lot of Sundays where I'm like, let's go on a hike, let's not go to church. And I was like, and a lot of times I'd come home from church and I would feel really frustrated. Like, something is missing here. I don't get it. Like, there's something substantial that we're not doing. When COVID happened and churches shut down for a little bit, that was just highlighted. I was like, you know, the pastors are putting cameras on them and they're preaching at the camera and playing some music. And I'm like, this is not church. There's something missing. And not just like getting together, but there's something fundamentally missing. And so it's like as I look back on it, I realized, like, after I left ministry, I was really deconstructing the evangelical church and the evangelical church experience. And I didn't know what the word deconstruction meant at that point. Yeah. But I was really frustrated with there is something absent from this worship experience.
Yeah.
This was also during the time of the race riots after George Floyd's murder in Minneapolis. And I'm really sensitive to issues of race. My godparents are black. I dated a black girl in high school, and I had my teammates were black that I served with in Michigan. And so I really have a heart for the black community and that culture. And so my heart hurt for them. And on social media, I'm seeing all of these posts that are really insensitive towards the black community. And a lot of them coming from the evangelical world. And I was like, why are people making these comments? I don't understand it. And what I realized that day, I was like, oh, wait. Church is a place where we're supposed to learn empathy. It's a place where we're supposed to learn how to love people that are other than ourselves. But the problem is that churches are very homogenous. You know, in 1960, Martin Luther King Jr. said, Sunday at 11 o'clock is the most segregated hour in America, and not much has changed. And so I was like, how are we to learn empathy if our churches are homogenous? And so it was then that I started really thinking about, like, when churches reopen, what am I looking for? And at the time, you know, my wife was an ER nurse, and so we had to take extra precautions because there were a lot of churches that just weren't. Yeah. And we didn't want to, you know, we didn't know if she was going to have COVID and bring it home and we were going to infect other people. We didn't know that if we certainly didn't want her to get sick because she's out there saving lives. And so I started putting together kind of a mental list of what I'd like to see in a church, you know, a church that's multicultural, but not just multicultural diversity inside of our four walls, but a church that had outside voices speaking into it from all over the world, you know, from Africa, from Asia, from, you know, all different parts. And a church that, you know, at the time I was involved with a couple of guys doing a book club, and I was reading Eusebius's Church History. Mm-hmm. And so I was really diving into that. I'm like, man, we never talk about church history, you know, maybe to the Reformation, but we don't go further back. Maybe some quotes by Augustine or someone like that, but we don't really go all the way back. And so I'm really hoping, I'm just kind of putting together all these things. I was like, a church that puts Jesus at the center, a church that de-emphasizes a celebrity pastor, you know, like a church that just focuses more on Christ. And I'm putting together this whole list. And then I ask myself probably the scariest question I've ever asked myself, and that is, am I looking for the Catholic Church? That's what...
Justin, let's take a break there.
Sounds
on
good.
That cliffhanger note, and we'll come back in and see what the fallout was from asking that $50 million question. So we'll be back in just a couple minutes to hear the rest of Justin's story. Again, I want to remind you, as always, that if you are on a journey, if you've maybe asked this crazy, scary question, could it be the Catholic Church, and you're interested in having people to talk to about that, resources about that, you can go to chnetwork.org. We've got a newsletter and videos and resources, but especially we have people who would love to hear your story. They'd love to empathize with you. They'd love to pray with you and for you while you work out these questions, while you listen to where the Holy Spirit's guiding you. So you can check that out at chnetwork.org. But in the meantime, we'll be back in just a couple minutes to hear the rest of Justin's story. See you in a minute. Well, welcome back to the Journey Home program. We're entering the second half of our hour tonight speaking with Justin Hibbard. He's a former evangelical minister and host of the Why Catholic podcast that we'll talk about a little bit here toward the end. But when we left off, Justin, you know, you'd been wrestling, and this is during the time of the pandemic stuff, and a number of things, you know, as you noted, have made you question, like, what's the principle of unity, you know, for the church? Why are we coming together on Sunday? What brings us together? What binds us together? When there's a very different people, what's the binding? What's the principle of unity there? And you weren't finding it, so you've been making this list.
Yeah.
You know, what would this thing look like? What's this strange creature that I'm imagining, this church that I would want to attend? And you asked yourself a scary question.
Yeah. Am I looking for the Catholic Church? And I it freaked me out because, like, I came from a very anti-Catholic background, you know, where... And I was like, and the first thing I'm thinking is, like, what do I tell my parents? Like, if I, like, becoming Catholic, or what do I tell my parishioners, like my former parishioners? Like, I couldn't possibly do this. But what I decided was, I was like, you know what? I've always learned Catholicism from the Protestant perspective. And that's not a great way to learn Catholicism. I really need to learn it from Catholics and really give it an open, fair shake. You know, instead of coming from it like, this is wrong and I'm right, or this is wrong and let me find out why it's wrong. What if it's right? What if I can just hear them out? The problem is that every time I listen to Catholics talk about Catholicism, they like talk over here. It's like they talk in this other world, and I'm over here, and I'm like, there's something that just doesn't connect. And anytime I don't want to learn from Protestants. I've listened to enough of R.C. Sproul and things like that, and they were big influences in my life. Maybe I could find some Protestant converts to Catholicism. I was like, I know a couple. I don't know that there are many out there. And I was like, maybe there's a podcast. I love podcasts. So I was like, maybe there's a podcast out there. And I was like, this is like a needle in a haystack. So I start searching, and I remember what I was searching for, but I come across this podcast called On the Journey from the Coming Home Network. And they were only like a few episodes in, and I turn it on, and Matt Swaim goes, I'm Matt Swaim. I'm a former Wesleyan who converted to Catholicism. And Ken Hensley comes on. I'm Ken Hensley. I'm a former Baptist pastor. And I'm like, I'm a former Baptist pastor. And I went to a Wesleyan college. I was like, this is weird, you know? So I'm listening to them. And I realized something pretty quickly. You know, we all have different shared worldviews. And then we have languages, shared languages to express our worldviews. And what I was doing was I was using my Protestant worldview and my Protestant language and trying to impose it on a Catholic worldview and a Catholic language. And you can't do that. Like, I studied languages. I studied in Spain. You have to use you have to immerse yourself in that worldview and use their language. The analogy that immediately came to mind was Gulliver's Travels by Jonathan Swift. Gulliver finds himself on this island called Lilliput with these Lilliputians, these like 6-inch creatures. And they're studying Gulliver, and Gulliver's studying them. And they keep seeing Gulliver pull out his pocket watch. He keeps pulling out his pocket watch. And they're like, what is he doing? They have no concept of Western time, no clocks. Mm-hmm. And they're like, I know what it is. That's his God. You know, and it's the absurdity that, you know, of what happens when we use our own constructs to try to define someone else's worldview. And so that's what was really helpful. And as they're talking about how they understood Catholicism, I'm like, yes, that's exactly how I thought of it. Oh, I have to think about it this way. And so I started off just being very quiet about this. Like, I didn't tell my wife I was thinking about it. I was just kind of listening to episodes, watching some things. There was a beautiful church in Park City called St. Mary's, which is not far from us. And we would drive by it to go skiing. And I remember saying to my wife jokingly one time, like, I would become Catholic just to go to that church. Like, it's so beautiful. It's right near the Canyon Ski Resort. And I was like, well, I want to check out that church. And so I turn it on, and there's the pastor there, Father Gray, is doing these, like, we call it St. Mary's Minutes, where he's like doing about prayer or about teaching about different things or singing the song in Latin. And I was like, wow, this is fascinating. Well, I became a little bit more vocal, like sharing with my wife, like, hey, I've been kind of looking into Catholicism. You know, I was very scared, very nervous about this. And she was like, oh, yeah, what have you been learning? We talked through that. And then right around winter time, so this has been winter of 2020, 2021, I said, what do you think about going to a Catholic church? I had found out that they were practicing social distancing, wearing masks, like just taking good precautions. And she was like, I'd be down with that. And my oldest was, she was studying church history. So she was like, yeah, like that sounds cool. My youngest was like, okay. And my middle child was like, nope, I don't want to do that. And so, we were like, well, let's just try it out. You know, let's see. And I really felt like there was only so much I could learn by listening to podcasts and reading books. I really need to immerse myself. I mean, this is how we study culture. We immerse ourselves in that culture and learn that language. And so I immediately did that. And it was beautiful. And my oldest came home from Mass and was like, that was really interesting. This was like right during Lent too. She was like, but it was really sad, you know? And my youngest was like, this is cool, you know? And my middle child was like, I want to go back to our old church, you know? So she made her concerns known from week to week about things. So yeah. I was just working through the different doctrines, you know? I liken it to whenever I talk to someone that's considering converting, I say it's like America with Ninja Warrior. You're going to have like obstacle course after obstacle course. Some are going to be easier. Some are going to be harder. And you just work through it. For me, the biggest obstacle was the Eucharist because I just could not wrap my head around how Jesus could become, you know, body, blood, soul, and divinity and present, really present with us in the bread and wine. I was like, how does this happen? I don't get it. I was always taught that it was a symbol. I told everyone it was a symbol. So we were attending a Bible study with our old evangelical friends from our church community. And we were studying 1 Samuel chapters 4 through 6. It's the story about the Philistines capturing the Ark of the Covenant, which is, I think, one of the most fascinating stories in the Bible. It's filled with crazy phenomenon. The Philistines, they capture the ark. They put it in their temple to the god Dagon. The next day, Dagon's laying prostrate in front of the ark. Then the next day, his hands and his head are cut off. And then people start growing tumors. And then they start playing hot potato with the ark of the covenant. They're like, I don't want it. Let's send it over here. And finally, they send it back to Israel. And Israel throws this big party. And then a bunch of people decide to open it up. And then they're dead. It's like Raiders of the Lost Ark after that, you know? Mm-hmm. And someone in the Bible study asked this question. She goes, is the ark God or is it a symbol? And I was like, I had never thought about that. I was like, that's such an evangelical way of it's either God or it's a symbol. There's no like nuance, like theophanies and things like that. But I was like, I'm working my head through this answer. And I'm like, well, it can't be a symbol because symbols don't make people sick. And symbols don't kill people. And right then, my brain switched to 1 Corinthians 10, where Paul's chastising the church at Corinth about, you know, you're not discerning the body and blood of Christ at communion. And for this reason, many of you are sick and some of you are falling asleep. And I'm like, it's not a symbol. And that was a real eye-opening moment. And it was at that moment that my whole understanding of Catholicism just flipped around. And I was like, wait. What we're doing here is like Yom Kippur. This comes back to my Jewish teaching where it's like,
I wondered about that because there's obviously lots of connections there between.
Yeah. Where if you looked at Yom Kippur, you would say like, well, this is rigid and boring. Here's this guy like taking a bowl of blood and carrying it into the temple and being very methodical and then coming back out. But it wasn't. It was haunting. And the reason why they were so careful was because it was so sacramental, and you are interacting. This is where heaven and earth are coming together. And when I understood that, I was like, Catholicism is not the most boring religion. I had it all wrong. It's the wildest. Mm-hmm. We believe that there's these, I think what Kenny Bouchard calls these thin spaces, you know, where the undercurrent of the supernatural pokes into our natural world, our time and our space. And I was like, this is amazing. And I was like, this is like the wardrobe of Narnia, you know, and I would walk into Mass and I would just envision myself walking through a wardrobe, and it changed everything I thought about Catholicism. I was like, I cannot be not Catholic after this. So, I shared with my wife, I was like, I think I'm ready to become Catholic. And she shared that she was at a very different place. And we had a hard conversation about that. And she's like, but I'm very supportive of you. And we talked about what it looked like with the kids. She's like, I just want to make sure it's their decision. And I was like, sure, I want to encourage them, but I understand like it needs to be their decision. And we approached our church. Our deacon, Tom Tosti, was amazing. He was like, I want you guys to come into church together as a family. And so he said, I'd like you to do RCIA classes together. And so my middle child, she was totally against it. You know, my oldest was like, yes, I'm definitely for it. My youngest is like, sure. You know, my middle child, like, nope, not doing it. And I said to her, I said, Naomi, I said, you know, you're going to be going to church with us anyway on Sunday mornings. Like, why not just come and see? You like, you don't have to become Catholic. Like, that was my understanding. It was like, you go to RCIA because you want to become Catholic. I didn't realize it was like a discernment process for a lot of people.
Right.
For me, I was like totally convinced. And so she agreed reluctantly. And it went from, I don't like this, to, oh, okay. All right. Yep. And we get closer to the Easter Vigil. And I asked her, you know, and I kept checking on her and like, how are you feeling? Like, do you want to become Catholic? No, I don't know. Probably not. And it was like, yeah, maybe, you know. And then she ended up coming into the Catholic Church. And I asked her, I was like, Naomi, what changed for you? Like, when was there a change? Well, leading up to the Easter Vigil, we had a family member come and visit. And I knew this family member was very anti-Catholic. And I warned my kids, like, FYI, like, this is probably going to happen. And they're probably going to say you worship Mary and some other stuff and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, we weren't there and it happened. He kind of cornered my girls and started kind of spewing the anti-Catholic stuff. Mm. And she said to me, she said, what changed was when this person said these anti-Catholic things to me. It was like that at that moment, she owned it and she saw it as this nonsense and it became hers. And I always think a little adversity is good. And it was that moment where she was like, I'm on this side of things. And that was what pushed her over. Right. And that was amazing. I'd never considered that, but yeah. So we entered into the church on the Easter Vigil. And it was amazing. I think one of the things too that I think one of the things that happened for me was right as we started RCIA, I was so nervous about telling people I was becoming Catholic. It's funny to think about it now. I'm so open about it, and I love talking about my Catholic faith. I was absolutely petrified. And I wrote a memoir. I'd been writing it for months about my journey to Catholic faith. I really felt like I wanted people to understand. Mm-hmm. You know, if they said, "What has gone on with Justin? Like, is it COVID? Like, he's been locked in his house too much? Like, what is it?" And I wanted to explain like my thought process for becoming Catholic. And so I wrote this long memoir. It's actually, you can still find it. It's at pilgrimagetocatholicism.substack.com, okay. And it's like 10 sections. And I wrote an email to my family the night before I published it. And I said, FYI, I'm going to share tomorrow that I'm becoming Catholic. You can read this ahead of time, you know. And that was the most terrifying email I've ever sent [S2] Yes. [S1] In my life. And my mom called me and we had a good conversation about it. And I had a friend reach out to me when I shared it and in a very loving way said, you know, I think you're making a mistake here. I'd love to come out there and pray with you, help you discern through this process. I was touched because it was out of love,
yeah.
You know, and his concern for me. And then he sent me a book that was like, What Roman Catholics Believe or Roman Catholicism, written by a Protestant and perspective. And I was like, this is what's wrong. I would love to help people understand the Catholic worldview and the Catholic perspective, because what I realized was the Catholic worldview is a sacramental worldview. What was missing all along from that church experience was the Eucharist. You know, that's what I was like. I was like, that's what's missing, you know? Yeah. And that's why I was so frustrated until I found it. And so I had in my mind, I would love to do this kind of like, I was kind of formulating it, this podcast of sorts. I had been in radio. I'd been doing podcasting. And so I was like, what if I do this little podcast and we do that? And I was kind of planning what it would be about, but it, like helping non-Catholics understand Catholicism, you know, from like from a friendly Catholic voice, and how there's differences, but also how there's a lot of similarities that would just sometimes talk past each other.
Right.
And so I waited a little while and finally kind of came together and I was like, I'm going to start this Why Catholic podcast. And through this process, it's been because one of the things I realized was there are, I call it the three levels of understanding another worldview. Mm-hmm. And one is I can articulate what I think is true about a worldview, where that's where most people live, especially on social media.
Yeah.
I can articulate what is actually true. And the third level, I can articulate why, the why behind it. And Simon Sinek, who's in the tech world, he talks about get to the why. And so understanding the why behind not just the what, but why do Catholics do these things? What is that worldview? And that's been my approach. What's been really interesting is that I've had tons of people come up to me saying like, hey, I'm a cradle Catholic and like I'm learning things I never learned before. And I was like, kind of my mind was blown at that point. And so I realized that my mission in life is to help people understand that question. Why Catholic? You know, why be Catholic? Why am I Catholic? You know, why do we do these things in the Catholic faith? And so that's kind of been my journey for the last little while. And I've gotten to help out teaching RCIA classes and everything like that. And so I just kind of see it as, you know, I was an apologist. I've been an apologist, I guess, since high school, you know, mm-hmm. writing about Christianity. And now I'm an apologist in the Catholic faith.
Yes. Well, thank you for your story, Justin. And we've got about 8 minutes left. And let's just flesh out just a little bit more what you've been talking about here with worldview and language. I think this is such an important thing. In every discussion or dialogue between people of different beliefs, whether we're talking Catholic, Protestant, or Christian, secular, whatever divide that you're looking across, this necessity of making sure that you're bridging the gap between language and worldview.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it begins with you need to make another person you need to make them confident that you understand their worldview, right? Like, because if you're making a caricature of their worldview, well, then, you know, why should they give yours the time of day? You have to show that you can speak their language first, that you've actually seen it from the inside.
Yeah.
Otherwise, your arguments are they're missing, yeah. right? You're speaking in two different languages, two different universes. Unless you can bridge that gap, so much of the dialogue in our culture is utterly fruitless.
Right? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think, you know, I think a lot of people live on level one, no matter where, you know, whether it's Republicans and Democrats talking
right.
or whatever.
Yeah.
We just tend to make caricatures. We tend to, and that, you know, like we run to our corners, right? Like, you know, we just digest the 24/7 news cycle, whatever our side says, because they just bash the other side. And that's not really genuine conversation. A lot of this, too, came from I had a podcast for a little while called Politics in Plain English, where my goal was to, you know what, I just want to explain the political landscape. It's not coming from any side. And really that helped me understand, you know, we just don't talk to each other. We talk against each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have to understand the complexities of the other worldview. And that's been really helpful for me where, you know, because and Catholics do it to Protestants as well.
Yes.
Like we have to say, OK, let's get above the caricatures mm-hmm. and let's get to the what do people actually believe. And if we can get to the why, then we're really showing empathy. We're showing that we understand, that we can empathize with them. So, you know, that started with me where I would say, you know, there was a scenario with a politician not being given communion by a bishop. And some of the people, a lot of Protestants in my circles were like, oh, that's terrible. And I was like, here's what you have to understand. This was before I was Catholic or even kind of in the discernment process. I was like, we have to understand this construct of why this is the case. So I think when you get to there, it's a lot easier to have these conversations with people.
Yeah, yeah. What does it look like from within this person's worldview? What does this thing look like? Or even with, I mean, again, you brought up language. so often when we try to have discussions with people, we haven't defined our terms.
Yeah.
Right? You're using this term.
Yeah.
And you mean something very different by it when you say it than I do.
Yeah.
And yet we're trying to have this conversation.
Yeah.
And you can't get anywhere unless you say, oh, no, what do you actually mean when you say this? Oh, you mean that? Well, that's not what I mean by that term at all. Right?
Yeah,
you
absolutely.
Have to clarify your language.
Yeah, and I think you have to do that with a lot of even the things we take for granted, the idea of grace, salvation. What do we mean by salvation? Because it looks very different in a Protestant once saved, always saved world in some Protestant circles with the Catholic worldview of salvation as a process.
Right, right, yeah. I think another part of the process of that dialogue, too, is sometimes you have to help another person clarify in their own worldview, their own beliefs, so that you can have that dialogue. Many people, Chesterton made this point, I think it was in the book What's Wrong with the World, but we have this sensibility as modern people that if we just round out the edges of our beliefs, make them kind of watery, take out the sharp edges, that we'll get along better. And we don't.
Right.
We end up with I only kind of have a vague sense of what I believe. I only have a vague sense of what you believe. And then we have to stay far away from each other because we're not really sure. But if I clarify what I believe, and I get real clear on what you believe, then we can walk right up to the edge, and say, we agree on this much, and here's where we actually disagree. And then we can talk about that.
Yeah.
You know, but unless you have clarity, you have to stay far away from people that are different than you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's so important. I think even understanding what you, like you said, like a lot of times we don't even understand what we believe.
Right.
And in high school, one of the things I appreciate is like, we really dove into apologetics. It wasn't like, know what you believe or know why you believe it kind of thing. And I remember having a conversation. I was a Baptist pastor. I had a conversation with a Catholic. I was counseling a parishioner who was dating a Catholic. They were having some conflict. And I said to her, I was like, well, you know, you got to understand there, you know, for her, it was like, look, he's Baptist, I'm Catholic, who cares, you know? And I say, well, you got to understand, like, you guys believe two very different things. You know, for example, the Eucharist, you believe that it's the real presence of Jesus. And she was like, no, we don't. And I was like, I'm pretty sure you do. It's like one of those things. At least your church does, And so I think a lot of times people don't even know what they're supposed to believe. And that's kind of why I do the Why Catholic podcast. I want people to understand, know what you believe and know why you believe it.
Very good. Well, again, to find that podcast, it's Why Catholic with Justin Hibbard. They can search for that on the internet. I also wanted to point out, again, you mentioned earlier the On the Journey show with Matt, Ken, and Kenny. That's the full title now. Yeah. People can find that as well. It's produced here by the Coming Home Network. And again, I think a similar approach to your podcast, it's sort of talking through, this is how I thought through these issues. We have a former a Methodist, a former Baptist, and a former Pentecostal on that show talking about it. So definitely check out Why Catholic with Justin Hibbard, and also On the Journey with Matt, Ken, and Kenny, two great resources for people on the journey.
Absolutely.
So, Justin, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having
your story.
Me. Appreciate it.
Appreciate it, and appreciate your work. I want to remind you, especially if you're on the journey to the Catholic Church, if you're asking questions, if you're interested, but especially if you're a pastor. Again, Justin shared a bit of his story, being in ministry, having this heart for ministry, and then having this opening by the Holy Spirit to the Catholic Church. If that's you, the Coming Home Network is specifically here to help pastors who are thinking about becoming Catholic. And so if you'd like to connect with other pastors, if you'd like to hear their stories, if you'd like a newsletter and resources to help you, you can check that all out at chnetwork.org. And we'd love to be praying with you and for you on your journey. So once again, thank you for joining us for this episode of the Journey Home program. I pray that Justin's story was a blessing to you. We'll be back again next week with another story. See you then. God bless.